We long to know the meaning of the gospel in life. Our hearts yearn for such a sense of meaning as our minds reach for the same. Last week, a devoted radio congregant, a weekly listener, wrote to respond to the service and sermon, doing so with an evocation of his years, the early 1960s, as a student here at Boston University. In a PS addition to the letter, he quoted Miguel de Unamuno, "My religion is to seek for truth in life and for life in truth, even knowing that I shall not find them fully while I live." The next day, another listener, friend, said, "These Marsh services are about life and truth." Said John Wesley, "If thine heart be as mine, give me thine hand." We have left St. Luke now to follow the trail of Jesus' life, death, and destiny this year in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew relies on Mark and then also on a teaching document called Q, along with Matthew's own particular material, of which our reading today is an example. He has divided his gospel into five sequential parts, a careful pedagogical rendering befitting his traditional role as teacher, in contrast to Luke the physician, whose interest was history. We have moved from history to religion, from narrative to doctrine. Matthew is ordering the meaning of the history of the gospel, while Luke is ordering the history of the meaning of the gospel. You have moved from the history department to the religion department. Welcome. Matthew has his own perspective. Some of that perspective involves a developing and developed Christology and understanding of Christ. For Matthew, the birth narrative conveys the proper ordering of the meaning of the history of the gospel. Birth narratives still matter. Birth narratives still have power, as if the politics of the last several years in this country were not enough alone to remind us. Matthew probes, who is he? Where did he come from? And where, who his parents? And who are his people? And who formed him, he who now forms us? You have missed having read the generations earlier in Matthew 1, from Adam to Christ. These are found before our reading. 14 by 14 by 14 are the generations, from Abraham to David, from David to Babylon, from Babylon to Christ. They run from Abraham to Joseph, who was betrothed to Mary, to Joseph, to and through Joseph, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Tamar, Amminadab, Boaz, Ruth, Jesse, David, Solomon, Uriah, Rehoboam, Jehoshaphat, Amos, Josiah, Jeconiah, Zerubbabel, Zadok, Eleazar, Matan, Jacob, Joseph. Every one of these names earlier in chapter 1 is worth a full sermon. We could start next Sunday. Matthew 1 tells of the birth of Christ, Jesus Christ, though a later scribe dropped Jesus, although most texts hold to it, perhaps to move Matthew a little more away from Luke, pushing religion away from history, you could say. The freedom we have to interpret the gospel for ourselves begins with the gospels themselves. Each is different from the others. John is magnificently the most different of them all, the most sublime, mysterious, and divine. Matthew tells of the birth of Christ, now the birth. Then he will tell of the teaching of Christ. Then he will tell of the healing of Christ. Then he will tell of the cross of Christ. Then cometh resurrection. In five moves, he is teaching us, Matthew the teacher. He orders the meaning of history as Luke orders the history of meaning. In the birth, it is the cradle we most need to notice. The wood of the cradle by which Christ is born is of a type with the wood of the cross by which Christ is crucified, born to give us second birth, the birth of soul, the birth of spirit, the birth of mind, the birth of faith, the birth of will, heart, love. Born to give us second birth. Is one birth not enough? No. You are meant to live in faith, to lead a life of loving friendship, to wake up every morning in the sunshine, the light of God. You are meant to walk in the light, to walk in the light. For this, you need to hear a word spoken from faith to faith. Christmas, as a cultural break, provides a seam, an opening for grace, both apart from religion and as a part of religion. You are given the light of God to rest in your hearts, to illumine your hearts and minds, to give you peace and hope all through the coming year. We will need that in 2017. We will need that courage this coming year. Matthew is apparently fighting on two fronts, both against the fundamental conservatives to the right and against the spiritual radicals to the left. In Matthew, gospel continues to trump tradition, as in Paul, but tradition itself is a bulwark to defend the gospel, as in Timothy. Matthew is trying to guide his part of the early church between the Scylla of the tightly tethered and the Charybdis of the tetherless. The people who raised us in the snows of the towns along the train tracks of the Lake Shore Limited, Albany to Buffalo and on to Chicago, knew this well. That is, with Matthew, they wanted 50 years ago to order the meaning of the history of the gospel. They aspired to do so by opposition to indecency and indifference. They attempted to do so by attention to conscience and compassion. At one time, the little towns and smaller cities of upstate New York were populated with scout troops and Methodist churches, one to foment decency and one to honor difference. The scouts at least had a list of 12 points in the law of the scouts that kept a measure of and on decency, whether or not every scout so lived. It is important to tell the truth. So a scout is trustworthy. The Methodists at least had a potluck dinner every Wednesday formed out of wide-ranging culinary differences, all brought together with the inevitable digestive turbulence, e pluribus unum, on a long table with a tablecloth not quite long enough for the table, saying, "The world is full of difference, so we get together and enjoy one another's odd casseroles as a foretaste of the globe." When asked to bring an artifact of his church, the Methodist brings not a Bible like the Baptist or a rosary like the Catholic or a yarmulke like the Jew, but a casserole dish to honor difference. Now, many of these towns today are depopulated, and many lack any longer a strong scout troop, and many lack any longer a vibrant Methodist church. This changes the culture, the civil society, in the rural lake country of New York. There is less traction for decency, less traction for difference. I suppose the same, a denigration of decency and difference, might be found too today in Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania. When, at an earlier age, you are not challenged to see and say, "That is not decent, that kind of speech," or you are not challenged to see and say, "That disrespects difference, that kind of talk," then you are more inclined to accept indecency and indifference, and you may be more vulnerable to demagoguery. We need more seminarians who will forego the joys of coastal urban life and go out or go home to the towns and cities of Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Iowa, Western Pennsylvania, and upstate New York. It is something to think about in this era, this season of burgeoning American indecency and indifference, our openness to the normalization of what is not decent and what denigrates difference. We had moved into Oneida, named for one of the Iroquois tribes, the year before. By that December, friendships had formed. Our scout troop, in the cold week after Christmas, assembled to drive the long, long distance, all of 20 miles, to Rome. That's Rome, New York, not the Rome to which all roads lead by any means, to swim in a relatively new YMCA pool. In the ice cold, to be transported to steaming warm water, the gym windows beclouded with moisture. What a treat. The cold earlier this week here brought the memory. But to get there, we needed four drivers, and only three arrived. It was a Saturday, and my dad was in the church office upstairs from our scout hall, probably trying to write a sermon for the next day, just 14 years after his own graduation from BU. "Dad, could you drive us?" With no spoken reluctance, he tapped his pipe, closed the notebook, and put on his coat. What fun! What joy! I suppose we worked on swimming merit badge along the way, but all that remains in memory is the laughter, going and swimming, warmth in the deeps of cold, and friendship in the deeps of anonymity. Warmth, warmth, warmth! We are dying of cold, not of darkness. It is not the night that kills, it is the frost. It is not the night of unknowing that kills, it is the frost of unloving. A scout is friendly, friend to all, and a brother to every other scout. Our family, four children, lived on the minister's salary, then $6,000 a year, and in the minister's parsonage. It was a living. They, parents, never complained to my remembrance. They were joyful, proud people. You live on what you have, so not to burden others. In those years, because you were eligible to move, to itinerate every spring or so, you planted a garden, taking pride in its planting, not fully knowing if you or another would harvest. There was a pride in the way these vegetable gardens were planted, hoed, and weeded. "They really make a good garden." That was high praise in the itinerant ministerial community, which, like all such, had its share of gossip. You take in pride in what you do. You take pride in what you do. Or as the Bostonian Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, any profession is great if greatly pursued. After the swim that evening in Rome, New York, because it was 5 or 6 p.m., the idea circulated among the swimmers that we should propose to the drivers to stop for a hamburger at a new hamburger chain, Carol's, it was called. The swimmers had the imagination, but the drivers had the money. This seemed like a top idea. Warmed in the swim and in the fellowship of friendship, I went to my father. He was filling his pipe and smiling. "Dad, the other guys are going to stop for a hamburger on the way back home. Can we go along?" My father was a genuinely and naturally happy, optimistic man. He did not let hurt easily confound him. Whoever said life was fair, that was his response to unfairness, hurt. So I remember that night because his face fell a little at the question, "Can we stop for a hamburger too?" I mentioned that my dad was a proud person, I think. He said something like, maybe, or we'll see. Then after a while, with the troop running around and shouting things, I saw him slowly walk over to one of the other drivers, who was a factory owner, a Methodist lay speaker, a friend. I saw a conversation in process. I saw my father looking at my friend's father. I saw my friend's father fish out his wallet. I saw my dad. I just wonder now how much it might have hurt him. Accept a few bills and put them into his own empty wallet. It was the end of the month, the end of the year, the week after Christmas, a time of quiet, but a time of lack, I guess. Having now lived a while, raised some children, seen and felt some hurt, maybe I should better appreciate a little what that moment, that willingness to sacrifice pride to give love, may have cost. In the icy winter in the atrium of a small YMCA on a Saturday afternoon with a sermon back on the desk still unwritten. If I had known then what I know now about what can hurt, I would not have asked. But if I had not asked, I would not have known now what I saw then. Life asks things of us when we are least prepared and when we least expect, but ask it does. How we respond becomes the alphabet of faith. For a time now, across our culture, and thanks in part to the weakening of scout troops and Methodist churches in the northern Midwest, indecency and indifference seem to have won the day. We do not need to recount in this country. We need to recant. Not to recount, but to recant. We have learned what Jeremiah warned us in September. You usually cannot know humility without first enduring the bitter suffering of humiliation. As a people now, we are learning the one through the other. Yet, nonetheless, nevertheless, hear the gospel. At least such is a first step toward humility. The further steps come in middling fashion upon a long road in the civil forms of civil society that slowly, slowly teach what we seem in part to have forgotten, decency and difference, not indecency nor indifference, but conscience and compassion. So we live into Advent in a difficult time, and there is little that can be said to minimize that dark difficulty. No. No false hope. We must face it and live it through, whether or not we can live it down. We simply will have to live it through. We can attend to affairs of state, to due process under the law, to respect for forms of government. It will take a decade. But remember, who hopes for what he sees? We hope for what we do not see, and we wait for it with patience. Zadie Smith knows about birth and about a warm swim on a cold winter night, writing, "Things have changed, but history is not erased by change. And the examples of the past still hold out new possibilities for all of us, opportunities to remake for a new generation the conditions from which we ourselves have benefited. Progress is never permanent, will always be threatened, must be redoubled, restated, and reimagined if it is to survive." Or here, Vaclav Havel. Hope is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world beyond our horizons. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, no matter how it turns out. We long to know the meaning of the gospel in life. Our hearts yearn for such a sense of meaning as our minds reach for the same. May such meaning fill your longing and feed your yearning this Christmas 2016.